For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget. With no annual servicing needed and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 29, and I am really excited about this episode because I love talking franchises, because you and I get to rank them. We get to talk about multiple entries of the franchise. We get to go one through however many. We get to talk about directors. We get to talk about actors.
It's an entire retrospective series all in one episode.
Exactly. And I love doing that. And this is one of the most beloved franchises in my life. Like, I grew up on this franchise because when the first film came out, it was in 1996. I was 12 years old.
I actually remember the first one too. I can't say I grew up with them because I'm mostly a newbie to at least four out of the five of the ones that now exist. But you couldn't not be alive in 1996 and not have some knowledge of this movie coming out.
And to actually tell you what we're talking about, what we're talking about is the Mission Impossible franchise. That's right, we're doing an episode because Rogue Nation just came out a couple of weeks ago, and we wanted to do an entire retrospective surrounding the Rogue Nation release. And I am so interested because we've done this a couple of times where I've been an old fan of the franchise and you've been a newbie, or I've been a newbie and you've been an old fan. And I love the dual perspective on that. And so I'm excited to jump right in. But before we go into that, I talked about this on my other show, To the Journey, with Charlene Schmidt. Vegas, Star Trek, 2015. You were there. You experienced it. Tell us what it was like.
I'm still recovering from it. I mean, like, anytime you take a vacation, I think that you end up coming back more tired than when you went. But when that vacation's in Las Vegas where there are no hours and you're just expected to stay up for 24/7, yeah, it's really, really – it took a lot out of me physically, but I got to say it was a whole lot of fun. I mean – lots of stuff happened this year. I met up with Charlene, as you know, and I listened to your To the Journey so I could hear you be jealous of the two
of us. Hardcore jealous, yeah.
But yeah, just so much stuff happened this year. I mean, you, for listeners who haven't listened to the To the Journey episode, I highly recommend it. You guys went through a lot of the highlights there. I mean, obviously the biggest highlight this year was the Star Trek Voyager 20th reunion panel. It's their 20th anniversary this year. And that was a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be because, I never having seen the Voyager crew all together, I didn't know what the dynamic would be like. I mean, the Next Gen crew, we all know that they were friends and they goofed around on set. And mm-hmm. I've never heard too much about the Voyager crew, how they all interacted. And especially the only major stuff that I heard about was the old Kate Mulgrew, Jerry Ryan not getting along so well sort of thing. I'm very happy to report that they managed to be even sillier than the Next Gen crew. And that, I mean, what I'm really happy to see is that they sat, I thought it was real interesting, they sat Kate Mulgrew and Jerry Ryan right next to each other. And there's absolutely no trace of any sort of lingering hard feelings. It seems that whatever differences they had all those years ago, they always managed to be professional on set and in through their work, and that always came off, and it looks like whatever animosity may have been there is there no longer. So that, as a fan of both of those women, was very nice to see.
Yeah, we briefly talked about that on To the Journey, and it was really nice because Char was there when I think they first met for
yes.
the weekend.
Yeah, because she did a they had a I would have done this had it not been $400.
Good Lord.
Yeah, that's how much this was. There was a photo opportunity where you got to take your picture with the entire Voyager crew for $399, which might as well, be $400.
That's insane. She did not admit that on air, that she spent that much. But she did say that she split it with Lori.
Which is the only, like, she told me that, and I was like, okay, at least that's somewhat economical. $200, maybe I could justify. But $400, that's, you know, I'm not ashamed to say, that's about half my paycheck after taxes, you know?
That's insane.
So I did not partake in such a venture. But from what I understood, I had a couple friends, including Char, who were there for that. And yeah, apparently when they all saw each other for the first time, it was a very, very magical thing. Personal highlight for me is my yearly encounter since 2013 with Terry Farrell. She's been there ever since I don't think I've mentioned it on this show, but years ago I used to do a show called The Delta Quadrant. We actually just finished back up in May, and back in 2013, we actually got the opportunity to speak with Terry Farrell, who happens to be my favorite person in Star Trek. She played my favorite character in Star Trek. I love Jadzia Dax. And so getting to meet her that first time was really, really cool. She was probably the best person that I've met so far, because there's always that old saying about how you should never meet your heroes or people you look up to, because, you know, you'll inevitably walk away disappointed. She's been so kind to me, and it continued this year, because I always go get her autograph, because that's the only time I'm going to get to have any sort of like face to face time with her. And it's gotten so where this year I step in front of her. She looks up from where she signed it. I don't even need to say anything. She recognizes who I was.
Oh, that's cool. That's nice.
And not only that, but she jumped up and gave me a hug. Her son was with her. She introduced me to her son, who's 11 years old. You know, it was just one of those things. And you know, I try to be the cool person. I try not to fanboy out over people. But, I mean, I don't think I got off more than a few words to her, because my mind went blank that she just recognized me.
That's so cool. Because I remember last year you said that, you know, you were surrounded by people, and she's like, it took her a second. She's like, okay, yeah. No, I remember you. I had a great time and everything like that. Yeah.
Yeah. This year didn't even need to do any of that. She just looked up and she's like, I totally recognize your face. And so she got up. She was so happy to see me.
Well, you know, if you think about how many conventions a Star Trek actor does throughout the year and how many people they meet at said conventions, it's absolutely great that you were able to have that kind of impression.
And not only that, I knew she knew it was me specifically, because she turns to her son who's there, who's wondering, you know, why she's getting up for this person and no one else. And she's like, oh no, this is Matt. He interviewed me 2 years ago. So, you know, she knew exactly who I was. And I think she asked me, because she's coming back next year and she wants to do the part of the costume record counter, whatever that thing is, the Guinness Book of World Records. She's like, what should I wear next year for my costume? And I said, I think you got to go old school. I think you got to do the original series what you wore in Trials and Tribulations. And she's like, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do.
I was forming those words on my lips as she asked that question through you. I was just like, oh, you got to go TOS, baby.
And that's what she wants to do. So next year she'll probably end showing up in the red miniskirt.
Hopefully in the beehive.
Yeah, well, the one year she actually did do the costume contest, she pretty much wore what she wore in Trials and Tribulations, but it just looks good on her. So hopefully she takes my advice and that's what she does next year. But, you know, meeting up with people was fantastic. The after parties are why everyone goes now, because this is my fourth convention since 2012 in Vegas. And after a while, I mean, yeah, the actors are great. It's fun to see them. It's cool to get their autographs. It's cool to chat them up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you kind of heard the stories, all the stories that you could possibly hear by that point.
Right.
So the reason I go is for the other people, and that was fun. I mean, it ranged from, you know, dinner with Char to actually there was a group of us, someone who used to be at the Delta Quadrant as a frequent guest, was there with her husband and a group of friends, and we ended up going to their hotel room. They brought their laptop and we ordered pizza and we just watched Voyager and drank. So that was fun. I mean, it's stuff like that. The reason why you go, it's one big party for you know, from Thursday to Sunday. And actually, next year they're extending it a day, so it'll be from Wednesday to Sunday.
I saw that. Yeah, I went on the website and I was surprised to see that. Well, I'm really glad that you had such a great time, and I'm glad that you got to collect so many memories. And I'm going to try my absolute hardest to come next year.
Well, you have no excuses. I mean, I've already got the room saved, and I'm willing to share with you, so...
Yeah, I was surprised that, like, yes, Matt Hansen booked his room a year in advance.
Well, first of all, next year's the 50th anniversary, as Star yeah. Trek fans will know, so I already figure that demand is going to be pretty high at this convention.
Yeah, and the prices weren't that bad at all.
No, it really wasn't, and I really think that they knew that the demand was going to be high, because I even tweeted, 5 days after the end of this year's convention, next room's discount sales are already posted online. So you can get your room now for the discounted rate for convention goers. So I did, because I just didn't want to be left out in the cold. And really, I got to say, since the convention is at the Rio Hotel, there's really nothing better than just having to go downstairs to the convention. You don't have to get in a taxi. You don't have to walk anywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to walk inside the hotel because it's a really long convention hallway. But, you know, you just go downstairs, and there's nothing more convenient than that. So I snatched up my room right away.
Well, that's really cool. And I definitely appreciate that, because if I can go, which I am, as I said, I'm going to try my absolute hardest. I am definitely looking forward to spending most of the time with you and seeing everybody else in person, because I haven't met any of these people in person yet. I've not yet met a single Twitter follow or Star Trek comrade that I've met online in person, so that'll be a lot of fun. But I just can't wait to get the three of us in a room together, you, me, and Char. But let's go into it. Let's get into Mission Impossible. Let's start the show. As everybody knows, Rogue Nation has come out, and you've already been able to see it two times thus far.
Actually, three times. As everybody doesn't know, but I will now embarrass you. We had 3 weeks in between this last recording and now, and I told Tristan we're doing Mission Impossible next time. I teased at the end of last show, and I said, I'll give you 3 weeks. That'll give you enough time to go see the movie. I'm going this weekend back when it was opening up, and we'll talk mm-hmm. about it when I get back from vacation. I've seen it three times. Tristan, how many times have you seen the movie?
Let's carry that.
Oh, that would be none.
That'd be zero. Yeah, that'd be zero. Yeah. I'm sorry. I tried. I really did try. I looked online. I looked at ticket prices. I looked at dates, and I tried to make it happen. And every single time, something came up.
Oh, listeners, he tried so hard because he knows how much he loves theaters. I'm sure he tried his best.
Yeah, maybe not my best, but I did try hard. But okay, so Rogue Nation came out, and it's getting rave reviews. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to finally seeing it. And you're going to give a spoiler-free review at the end of the show.
Yes.
Because we want to start from one and move our way over. Let's start at the top, which I always think is a good way to go. Mission Impossible 1, or aka Mission Impossible, came out in 1996 and was directed by Brian De Palma. Now, I love this movie. I saw this right when it came out. I was infatuated with it. I thought it was great. And I was surprised when I was doing the research for this podcast, and I was trying to get all the Rotten Tomato numbers. Looking back, it only got a 62%.
Yeah, barely fresh.
Barely fresh. Barely, barely, barely fresh. And it is so odd to me because... I mean, we're going to give our ranking, but I'll just say this right off the bat. This is my favorite one. This is my absolute favorite one of the series. I think this is masterful.
I ended up really liking this movie. Now, this is, as listeners may or may not know, I'm the newbie to this franchise. And before I had rewatched them all in preparation for Rogue Nation, the only one that I had seen was Ghost Protocol. Mm-hmm. So I had never seen MI1 until this year. I'm a big Brian De Palma fan. He directed one of my favorite movies from the 70s, Carrie. But I had never seen this movie before, and I really like this movie. However, I think that some of the maybe the initial resistance from critics at the time was that it is a very, very complex movie that not all the plot threads tie together necessarily. I mean, this was one of those movies where I actively had to pay attention to know what was mm-hmm. going on. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it was really fun, and I really enjoyed this movie.
As I was reading some of the reviews, that was the main criticism that I saw as well, is that it had a convoluted plot, is what they said. And when I saw it at 12 years old, yeah, sometimes I had a hard time following the plot, but I was also 12. Once I reached the ripe old age of 13, I figured it out. You know, I never quite understood people who criticized a movie for being hard to explain or hard, like when people say like, oh, you have to pay attention all the time. I'm not saying you said it as a criticism, but some people say that as a criticism, And that just boggles my mind. I was like, yeah, you have to pay attention. It's a movie. You're there to watch the movie, so watch the friggin' movie. That was a key thing with Inception. So many people said, like, oh, just because it's complicated doesn't mean it's good. I was like, no, I'm not saying I'm a smart person because I followed it. I'm saying you're dumb because you couldn't follow it.
I mean, you are preaching to the choir here. One of my favorite movies of all time, as I've iterated time and time again on this podcast, is 2001. I can't explain it to you. There's no definitive explanation for that movie. I think it's open to your interpretation. But yeah, I'm okay with having to pay attention to a movie. I'm just saying that in this first one specifically, I think that there are, and as there are with all of them, but I felt it most in this first one, there are a couple of leaps of faith that you have to take with the movie to get from plot point A to plot point B, if that makes any sense.
I get that. And I wasn't yelling at you. I'm yelling at the general dumb audience member that complains, and that is by no way you.
Right. I mean, there's a point in MI1, and we don't have to go through the plot or anything, but it's toward the beginning where he's trying to figure out what Job it means or job, or he thinks it's job. And yeah. he's on the computer, he's trying to figure it out. He just happens to look up and there's a Holy Bible, and he makes the connection. Oh, it must mean Job. Job, the book of the Bible, sort of thing.
Wait, that was the stretch for you? Really? That was the stretch?
That was a stretch. And then toward the end, when he's trying to piece it together to find out who's actually the main villain of the movie, that was kind of I don't know what just happened there, but I trust you because you're the protagonist of this film, sort of thing. But other than those couple of things, I mean, that movie really holds up, and I was surprised how much it still holds up. Obviously, I think the best part of that movie is the part that everybody remembers. It's the break-in at Langley, which is the part that I enjoyed the most out of that first one.
Yeah, that scene has become iconic. I mean, that has permeated our culture. I mean, like, everybody, even if you've never seen the movie, everybody knows that scene. And there was no music and practically no sound for like 10 minutes. And it was geniusly done. That's why I'm saying that this was a masterclass in the directing craft by Brian De Palma, which has, I mean, yeah, he directed Carrie and he's directed a lot of good films, but out of his entire history, because he's been directing since the 60s, but yeah, out of his filmography, he has a real hit or miss ratio.
It's true.
But this scene alone is enough to make it a fantastic film.
And I wondered why you get De Palma for this. I'm not saying that he's a bad director, but normally with my mind being going to stuff like Carrie and Untouchables, I mean, you associate De Palma more with suspense. And I'm like, when you come into a Mission Impossible, you just assume it's an action film.
Frame your reference here, because you just answered your own question. Okay, because he says, like, Brian De Palma is mainly known for suspense. And when you think Mission Impossible, you think action film. This was the first Mission Impossible film. So no one thought that yet.
Well, I know that, but, like, you have to understand, I'm coming in as a new fan with the entire franchise in mind and what it's become. Because, like, mm-hmm, I said, the only one I had seen at this point was Ghost Protocol, and which is definitely a little bit more action than that first one. I realize with that Langley scene why you get to Palma, because it is suspenseful. Okay.
All right. I cut you off and you were explaining yourself. I remember having a conversation with someone when the third one came out, and I was talking about how great the third one was and how horrible I thought the second one was, is that I was like, Mission Impossible 1 is a thriller. Like, I don't even consider it an action film. I consider it a thriller. And Mission Impossible 2 is a mindless action film.
We have to, we'll get there.
We'll get there. But, and with 3, I felt like 3 was your much more modern action film. And, like, I was able to explain that to someone by describing, like, that was the kind of the evolution of the franchise. And so that's why I like going back to the first one, because the first one is so different from all the other ones.
And yet I'm going to argue when we get to MI3, they managed to recapture more of what I liked about the first one than the second one did.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm going to agree with you there. But with the first one, one of the things that I really loved, and you'll like this comparison that I'm about to make, is that in Scream, you had Drew Barrymore, who was on all the posters and, you know, who was in all the trailers and everything like that. She was killed off in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And with Mission Impossible, you have really great actors.
Yeah, I was surprised at how much they're not here. I mean, I had heard about Emilio Estevez was in this movie and he dies. I didn't know it was happening in the first 15 minutes. I just knew he was marked for dead. But like him and Kristen Scott Thomas, I was surprised at the level of, I mean, I guess they maybe weren't as, well, Emilio was, but he was on the way down.
Yeah.
But, you know, the level of actors that you get just for this opening mission where they're all killed.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that, like, we're going into this thinking, okay, here's the IMF team, all right? This is our new crew. We got Tom Cruise, Emmanuel Barrett, John Voight, and all these people. And then, boom, almost all of them get wiped out, and we see their death. And then we're just like, holy crap, what are we going to do now? And so we're lost and we're alone, just like Tom Cruise. And so we're along for the journey. That's beautiful.
And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the only reference that people back in 96 would have had for Mission Impossible would be the old series, because this is, right, of course, based off of a series. Mm-hmm. And I've not seen that series, but correct me if I'm wrong, that series was always like an ensemble series. It was a team going in and doing these things.
Yep.
So to have, you know, and you start with a team in this film, and to have them killed off in the first 15 minutes, that must have thrown people who were familiar with the franchise at this point for a loop, because, you know, there is no team.
Absolutely.
In this movie.
Yeah.
Well, there is a team later, but, I mean, the team that you start off with is not the team that you're going to go through this film with.
And I think that's one of the many reasons why this movie is so great. I'm surprised it's so low in the ratings, but I think it's incredibly underrated.
Well, also, too, I mean, I also know from reading that certain people didn't like it because the character that John Voight plays was the hero in the original series.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, this Phelps character that ends up being the villain in the first movie.
Oh, I thought you meant John Voight. I was like, I don't think he was in the TV show.
No, the character that he played, Phelps, was the lead in the series, and he was always the good guy.
Hmm.
So I think that turned a lot of people off from what I read back in the day.
Well, you know what the Joker says is that you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying, like, it's very, very parallel to some of the response that, like, something like the new Star Trek films have had.
Yeah, that's really funny when you put it that way. But, well, I mean, I could talk about this particular movie all day, but we should probably move on, and I don't want to move on.
Do we have to move on?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so everybody listening at home, Mission Impossible 2. Don't even watch it if you haven't seen it. Go for Mission Impossible, and then just watch Mission Impossible 3. Because here's the thing. This was directed by John Woo and came out in the year 2000, but feels like it came out in 1992.
Yeah, well, 1992. It feels like it came out in 2000. It feels like a John Woo movie from that era. Like when you think of Face Off, it's the same kind of kind of dynamic.
Face Off was cool. Okay, Face Off was good. That was a movie that was aware of its own existence. That's the thing. Face Off was aware of how over the top and
cheesy
it was.
It's the same kind of style, though.
And that doesn't matter. It's the same kind of style, same kind of epic action sequences, same kind of slow motion doves, dual guns. Okay, but it was aware of what it was doing. Mission Impossible 2 was blind to its own vision.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem. And now, I had heard before watching these that everyone agreed, pretty much was in agreement, that the second one was the weak link in the series. And having watched it now, yeah, that's definitely true. And I think the problem is exactly what you just said. I don't think they realized what they had with that first movie. The first movie worked because it was a spy thriller. It went, and then, you know, honestly, the vibe that I got from Mission Impossible 2 was that they were trying to chase the feel of the later Brosnan Bonds, which would have been big at the time. A lot, you know, just from certain dynamics, like the way that one of the first meetings in the movies between Tom Cruise and the love interest, quote unquote, Tandy Newton, which no chemistry at all, but we'll set that aside for the moment. One of the first encounters they have is the two of them trying to out chase each other on a mountainside, and then the whole time I'm just thinking, this is Bond and Xenia on a top from GoldenEye. It's shot almost the exact same way.
Yeah, there was a lot of copycat sequences from other movies, and John Woo being a copycat of his own work. And like you speak of Face Off, like we have the ultimate conclusion at the end of the film where they're playing chicken with two motorcycles, and then they jump off the motorcycles, hit each other in the air, and then fall down a cliff onto the beach. In Face Off, they do that with boats, and the explosion makes them fall forward and land on a beach, and then the final thing's on the beach. It's almost like a shot-for-shot remake. It's insane.
But I think one of the biggest problems in this movie, and I mentioned it just briefly, but the love story that they want to introduce. I love Tandy Newton, and I've actually grown to like Tom Cruise a lot, especially through watching these films. They don't mix.
No, I love Tom Cruise. I don't know too much about Tandy Newton, as all I really know about her is from this film, and as I like to call it, the woman who can't wear clothes that quite fit.
Right.
And with I love Tom Cruise movies. Like, I don't care what you think about him personally. I think he makes a great film. But with Mission Impossible 2, they tried to shoehorn this romance in there, and I could have sworn I saw an actual shoehorn. I mean, it was insane because they meet up, and then they immediately have sex, and then quote-unquote fall in love within 8 hours. And then they John Woo, like, packs in these little weird manufactured tension moments where they are looking at each other longingly, and then it goes in slow motion, and we're supposed to feel something for these characters that we know nothing about, at least with their history with each other, because it's hours old. And it's just, it makes no sense. You're just like, half the time you're like, is this a romance film? What is this? And most of it's in slow motion, and you hear the woman from the Gladiator music, like, just going, you know, in the background. You're just like, I know that, like, the movie is telling me I should feel something, but it's not actually making me feel something.
None of this is working. And there's, you know, every Mission Impossible, save this one, always has a great suspense slash action centerpiece. I don't know what it was in this movie. I guess it was supposed to be the part where he drops down into the skyscraper building, but even then, it pales in comparison to Langley.
Absolutely, it pales in comparison, and that I think that was a suspension thing. But what Brian De Palma did by deeds, John Woo tried to do by slow motion and imitation.
Right. Well, I will say, Tristan, there's one positive thing to come out of this movie, and it has nothing to do with the movie itself. I don't know if you've heard this, but Doug Ray Scott, who plays the villain in this movie, who coincidentally is the weakest villain in all five of these ones. I'll just go ahead and spoil it for Rogue Nation. Rogue Nation is way better than this guy. But he was originally slated and signed on to play Wolverine in the X-Men film that was coming out same year as this, 2000.
Yep.
And because this went over schedule, he had to be replaced, and that's how we got Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. So thank you for Mission Impossible for running Mission Impossible 2 for running over schedule. Hugh Jackman is Wolverine and now has a career, and those movies are successful.
Can you imagine? My wife and I were just talking about this. Can you imagine being Doug Ray Scott and saying, like, oh, well, you know, Mission Impossible, it's going to be a big film. It's directed by John Woo. It's going over schedule. Oh, well, I mean, I'm contractually obligated, but, you know, X-Men, it's a comic book film. Comic book films don't really do that great. I'm sure it'll be okay. And then Hugh Jackman has a career because of his over schedule. And can you imagine being him? Because he is nowhere now. He's nowhere.
No, I don't think he's ever worked anything big since, but
he's done Taken 3, and that was the latest thing I saw him in.
Which, you know, again,
It's
Taken 3. But, I mean, I'm not saying that mentality was wrong back in 2000, because back then Mission Impossible would have been the right thing to do. Comic book movies were just coming off of Batman and Robin.
Yeah, absolutely.
This was before the Renaissance, but yeah, you wouldn't want... It's the same thing that I heard with... Tim Roth doing the Planet of the Apes remake. He did the Planet of the Apes remake and turned down doing Snape from Harry Potter.
Oh, no! I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, as much as I love Tim Roth, I really do. Like, no BS, love Tim Roth. Alan Rickman is Snape.
I mean, he has more of a career than Doug Ray Scott, but it's the same kind of thing where it's like, no, Planet of the Apes is probably going to be the bigger hit. I'll just turn down this kid's franchise.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that happened, too, because Alan Rickman was definitely the right choice. Now, okay, so Mission Impossible 2 got a 58% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's only 4 points lower than the first one.
Yeah, it's much worse than the first one.
It's so much worse. I was expecting, like, a 30% when I looked this up. But here's the real kick in the slacks. And this is what kind of makes me sad about America.
I thought you were gonna bring up who wrote it. I was like, that is a kick in the slacks.
But... Oh, that's the second kick in the slacks, and we'll get to that one, but... Mission Impossible 2 is the lowest rated, most grossing Mission Impossible film to date in America.
In America.
In America.
And, well, here's the thing, right? I think that with box office, especially back then, you're only as good as your last movie. I think a lot of that is owed to MI1. Because I think MI1, despite the mediocre Rotten Tomato score, I remember 1996. That was a big hit. It was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And merchandise was everywhere. I remember in the vein of, you know, trying to chase GoldenEye, the N64 video game, we had Mission Impossible, the N64 video game, which was in itself impossible to play.
That was more convoluted than the movie.
Yeah.
I did not remember that game until you brought it up just now. Now, here's the thing. to put things in perspective, though, is like, yes, it makes me angry that it's number one in America, but when you go into worldwide, it's number two. It's still number two worldwide. So right now, Ghost Protocol is number one. But the thing is, if you adjust it for ticket inflation for a domestic gross, Mission Impossible is number one.
Wait, Mission Impossible 1 or 2?
Mission Impossible 1 is the top grossing film out of the entire series domestically if you adjust for inflation.
Right.
Which I think is pretty cool.
No, it is cool. And like I said, I think that's why this one was successful financially, because there's a lot of goodwill coming from that first one. Mm-hmm. And again, with the first one, I remember 2000 very well. I mean, I was 11 years old at the time. This one had a huge marketing campaign. It was opening the summer that year.
Yep.
So, I mean, of course, it's going to have a big financial success. But I think it's a little telling that it's a long 6 years after this one and Mission Impossible 3. And also, I think the reason that he comes back to do Mission Impossible 3 is Tom Cruise didn't have a very great 2005, let's say.
Before we get into that, because we should talk about, there's two other things that I want to talk about with Mission Impossible 2.
That makes
me sad, is because our beloved people in our beloved franchise of Star Trek, Ronald D. Moore and Brannon Braga. Brannon Braga is responsible for Voyager. Ronald D. Moore is responsible for a lot of things that happened in Deep Space Nine. They developed the story. They did not write it, but they developed the story for Mission Impossible 2.
Right.
And here's the thing. Here's why I think I can forgive them. Because they developed the story, pitched it to the studio. The studio bought the story, but then had somebody else write it. But before the script was written, John Woo was approached to do the movie, and he said, okay, I'll do the movie if you put these action sequences into it. And they're like, well, we haven't even written the script yet. And he's like, well, I don't care. And so he made a list of what action sequences he wanted to do just because he's John Woo and all he cares about is the action sequences. Literally, all he cares about is the action sequences. And so they wrote the script around those set pieces.
I'm pretty sure that's the way Michael Bay directs now.
Exactly. That is why this movie is so terrible, because story should always come first. And I'm not that's not a hipster thing for me to say.
No, it's absolutely true. You can't do a movie based around action sequences. I'm pretty sure that's not how most action movies are written.
Right.
Now people will accuse it of that, but you know, I don't think it's true of every single one, but it definitely felt that way here. So I'm willing to exonerate Ronald D. Moore and Brannon Braga. They wrote movies that I've enjoyed before. So, you know,
me too. All right. So let's move on to number three. This is exciting.
This is exciting. And this needed, like I was saying, this came at a time where Tom Cruise needed a hit. He really did.
Okay. Here's the thing. I'm looking at his filmography right now. You said 2005 was not his year. He only made one film in 2005.
I'm talking about him, his public perception in 2005 suffered.
Right.
Because don't forget, 2005 is the year he's jumping up and down on Oprah's couch and giving that interview with Matt Lauer. This is when the Scientology stuff really starts to take over.
Yes, you're right. I completely forgot about that. Yeah. Oh, man. Personally, this was a horrible year for Tom Cruise. This is when, like, everybody already thought of him as this kind of weirdo, but 2005 solidified it in his personal life.
Come 2006, he needs a franchise hit. So I think that's why eventually Mission Impossible 3 does get made.
And Mission Impossible 3 was the directorial debut of J.J. Abrams.
Yes, it was. And you know what? I got to say that for all of Cruise's personal problems, which I remember thinking at the time, this guy is just nuts. But popping in Mission Impossible 3 and watching J.J. Abrams do his directorial debut, God, what a return to form from part two. This was way better.
I knew right away when I saw the trailer is that this was going to be different. Okay, this was going to be a solid action film. And it was. It was shot beautifully. It was edited beautifully. It had characters that you cared about, but not characters that overtook the scene. And it was a plot that you could follow, and they even made fun of themselves in the past two films because they called it the rabbit's foot, and no one even knew what the rabbit's foot was, and it didn't matter because it was just the MacGuffin.
Right, exactly.
Some people thought it was like lazy writing. I thought it was a wink to the audience because it doesn't matter
what it is. It's not important, and now having seen the five movies, when I get to it, Rogue Nation comes close. But I still think that 3 has the best opening out of all the movies, because 3 opens with that wonderful mise-en-scene sort of thing where you start in the middle, well, toward the climax of the movie, and you see what looks like Tom Cruise's wife in the film getting shot by Philip Seymour Hoffman, who I will go on and say, having seen Rogue Nation, is still the best villain of all of the Mission Impossibles.
When I saw that Philip Seymour Hoffman was going to be in the film, I was like, really? You know, Hoffman's going to be in a Mission Impossible film? How's that going to work? But holy crap, I wanted to stand up and clap with his performance, because he made a perfect bad guy. And he was just so sinister, and it felt like he wasn't even trying. And, you know, sadly, he's no longer with us. And there was somebody made a quote when his death was announced, and I can't remember who said it, but what they said was, when a great actor or director dies, or a great artist dies, we think of it as a loss when it comes to their work, because we never get to see anything more from them. With Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's a robbery.
Yeah, it really was. I had never seen him, any of his films, where he gives a bad performance. He was always, even when he was the first time I ever saw him in anything was when he was the crazy-ass storm chaser in Twister. And even then, he was fun.
Yep. Even then, it was a great performance.
The only thing that disappoints me about him in this film is the way he's taken out. I don't like that he's just run over all of a sudden by a car. That was kind of lame.
It was a lot like, yeah, it's kind of like how I felt with Bane at the end of The Dark Knight Rises.
That was a little anticlimactic. Not his fault, though. But...
No, not at all. And again, this was another thing that really surprised me, is that when I walked out of the theater, I was like, yes, people are going to love this film. Mission Impossible is back in force. It got a 70% on Rotten Tomatoes.
And is the lowest grossing of all of them.
That's so crazy.
I think, though, it has nothing to do with the quality of the film. I think it's from that I'm going to say that 2005 really hurt his public perception. And I think that it suffered as a result, because this is not a worse movie than 2. There's no way.
No. So
I think people were just put off by Tom Cruise at the time. And it's telling that he does projects in between there and here and there between 3 and Ghost Protocol. But I don't think he really had another like bona fide hit until Ghost Protocol after this.
Yeah, because here's the thing. Here's this movie's in between Ghost Protocol and Mission Impossible 3. You had Lions for Lambs, which everyone involved with that movie is trying to forget. You had Tropic Thunder, where he was really just a bit part.
And we didn't even know it was him. I don't remember knowing it was him.
And then you had Valkyrie, which he put his heart and soul into, and that crashed and burned.
Yeah, I don't remember that being a big hit.
And Night and Day? Oh my god. That looked so atrocious. I haven't even seen it, and I am not ashamed to say, like, this is a movie podcast, this is a geek podcast, and I know you're not supposed to judge something if you haven't seen it, but holy crap, no, I'm not seeing that piece of trash. And then he had Ghost Protocol.
Well, which we'll get to. But a couple more things about 3. They finally managed to put in a romantic interest story that actually I thought worked in comparison to 2. Now, his wife character really isn't in that much of the film, and for the better, I should say, because I feel like that would be a distraction if she was in more. But the way she's utilized, I thought, was way better, much more believable. You know, even the more minor players, I love Lawrence Fishburne, and I love for the time that she's in the film, Felicity, Carrie Russell. Now, and she has, I gotta say, when I think about the way people are killed in Mission Impossible, having something explode in your brain is really, really creepy.
Oh man! And when her one eye went off,
yeah,
like askew, like it went to the right, just jutted out real quick, and we heard that.
That really freaked me out.
That was a great action sequence. That's probably one of the greatest action sequences in all of Mission Impossible history. Now, not suspense, because the first one has that, but action sequences with the helicopter and the magnetic grenades and I was in my seat and I was literally gripping my armrest going, oh man, my heart was just racing. I hadn't had that kind of physical reaction in a film in a long time.
And her death really creeped me out. And I got to say too, I knew that this was the film because this is when JJ takes over, or, you know, Bad Robot's going to come in and start producing these films from now on. I mean, they're still associated with it.
Did they do Rogue Nation?
Yes, they did. Rogue Nation? Okay. Yep, he did. I also knew that this was the first movie that they were going to introduce Simon Pegg into the franchise. What I was not expecting is he's such a minor part in this third film. In comparison,
he really is.
Like he's there for maybe a scene to give some exposition, and that's it. I was shocked because when we get into the next one, his role expands enormously. And I think that that's probably because he became more of a known entity in the States. I mean, back in 2006, he would have just been the Shaun of the Dead guy.
Yeah, and in 2009, we had him as Scotty. You know,
I definitely want to say that Star Trek movie put him over the top, and so that's,
oh, absolutely.
So I'm pretty sure that's why he gets a much more expanded role in Ghost Protocol, and I'll just go ahead and spoil this up front. He manages to be even more central to the plot in Rogue Nation.
Now, okay, here's the thing. Before we move on to Ghost Protocol, there are criticisms with Mission Impossible 3. As much as I loved it, there are some things that are kind of cheesy and kind of weird. Now, the most egregious of these is the ending. Now, I'm not talking about the climax. I'm talking about the denouement, the falling action.
Which part are we talking about?
I'm about to get to it. Like, the IMF is a secret organization, and secret, emphasis on secret. And so, like, Ethan has this alternate, you know, not personality, but life that he has to lie to his wife. He's like, I work in, you know, traffic monitoring, you know, and I work at this building, and, like, I'm going on a business trip. He lies completely. And so they make their agents lie to their loved ones about their real lives and their work lives to protect them and to protect the nation and the world. And then at the very end, all of a sudden, just because she knows that he's a spy, they let her into their secret facility. And,
yeah,
you know, and like, they're to show her everything at the secret facility, that they're in the CIC. And, you know, like, Ving Rhames is for some reason shooting air guns in the air in slow motion because they're super excited that she's there. And it was just, it almost ruined the climax for me.
I don't want to say it ruined the climax for me. It's not very believable. It's not believable, but I know that's not this movie, but the way they end up dealing with the wife character in the next movie and just basically excising her from the series altogether was a good move. I liked Michelle Monaghan in this movie, but was I sad that her character doesn't really continue all that much? No, I think it would have been a dead weight. And I think that that's just the way that these films are. Bond can't stay married, and neither can Ethan
Hunt.
I
was just about to say that. I was like, Bond can't do that because, Britain has, even though it's American-made movies, but Britain has Bond in their culture. We have Ethan Hunt. You know, and I've always kind of felt that way. And I mean, you could argue that Jason Bourne is kind of our character too.
But even then, Jason Bourne, the girlfriend from the first movie, gets killed in the second movie. So yeah. You know.
Now I'm glad that they didn't kill her off, because that would have pissed me off. Because I hate the trope where man falls in love with woman and then woman dies just to enrage the man.
Well, you know, like, you mean you know, the ending to On Her Majesty's Secret Service?
Yeah.
Even though that's a great ending, I think.
Well, it's just they bit off more than they can chew with that. But that's a different discussion. So that was my main criticism of the film, and I'm sure it was with a lot of people.
Well, then I'm curious to see when we moved on to Ghost Protocol how you reacted as you were watching that film, because through 99% of that film, you think she is dead. They talk about her like she is dead.
Right. I was just... When I was watching it, I was just like, really? They just killed her off? Okay, fine. You know, I guess if that's the way we have to go. And then I was happy to see her at the end. Now, it raised more questions, I thought. I didn't think they really tied it up with a bow. I liked the idea of it, but I didn't quite like the execution.
Well, I say it's tied up because there is no mention she is not in Rogue Nation.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, like, when we saw her at the end of Ghost Protocol and everything's cool and everything's okay, I'm looking at her, they see each other, and I'm just kind of like, okay, so how'd it go down? Like, did they say, okay, we have to get, do they still love each other? Or did they realize we have to get divorced because of how I lead my life? Or did they have a falling out? You know, I don't know, it was weird.
I'm not dying for those answers, though, personally, and maybe that's Mission Impossible 6, but I don't need it to be Mission Impossible 6.
No, I'm not saying, like, give us a prequel or anything like that, or give us a backstory. I'm just saying those questions were raised. I'm not saying I needed to see them on screen. I'm just saying those were the questions in my head.
Well, enough dancing around the bush. I mean, we've both ended up loving Mission Impossible 3. I think it set the franchise back online. But again, it was kind of a relative disappointment. I mean, it only grossed 320-something million worldwide. Mm-hmm. So I did not know that we were going to get any more Mission Impossible movies. And it took five – this is a franchise where they're not afraid to take long breaks in between sequels. Yeah. Because it's another 5 years before we get – Ghost Protocol, a movie I dare say no one thought was going to be as good as it was or do as well as it did.
Yeah, I was surprised because when I saw the trailer for Ghost Protocol, I was just like, okay, cool. You know, it's another Mission Impossible film. I'm sure it'll be by the numbers. I'm sure it'll be just as good as Mission Impossible 3. I'm sure it'll get mediocre like ratings, but generally favorable. But then all of a sudden, boom, 93%. And from a director who had no live action experience.
No, this is Brad Bird, the guy who had just done The Incredibles, which you and I both mentioned we liked on our Pixar show. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no live action experience, and you know, not a household name, but neither was J.J. Abrams back then either.
Not at that time. No, he was a TV guy. I mean, it's funny, like, you know, J.J. came from TV and Brad Bird came from animation.
We'll have to talk about it when we get toward the end of our discussion, but it's been real interesting that they've brought in a new director each time. And, you know, whether the film's been good or bad, each of them has put a specific feel to their film. And I kind of like that.
I like it, too. But here's the thing is that was never done on purpose. Brian De Palma was asked back for Mission Impossible 2 and declined. Brad Bird was asked to come back for Rogue Nation, but declined. And I think it really just kind of had a way of working itself out. Now, I have no idea if John Woo was asked back. Now, that would be a really scary thing.
No.
But yeah, I that was definitely not by design.
I guess JJ couldn't have been asked back because he was doing Star Trek and Super 8 at the time.
Right.
So
he probably would have been welcomed back if they would have had him because he did produce it. So it's not like he lost interest.
Even JJ produced films have a certain feel to them, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of people think he's a better producer than he is director.
That's a debate for another day. I think he's a good both, but,
I do too.
So Ghost Protocol comes out. This is the first one I actually end up seeing in theaters because unlike all the other ones to that point, this one was not released in summer. It was released at Christmas time in 2011. Mm-hmm. And I remember being on break from school at that point, and we were all going to see it. And I thought, well, I haven't seen any other ones. I don't know if I'll be confused or not, but it's gotten really good reviews. And I ended up really loving it back then, even when I didn't know these characters. Having watched it again, through the graciousness of you, by the way, because you gave me a digital copy many years back, having watched it again, now knowing these characters, do I spoil this at this point? No, I don't want to spoil this at this point, but that this was a franchise that just kept getting better through its sequels. Barring that second one, three was a step back, and I think four is better than three, even though I loved three. But Ghost Protocol at the time was the peak for me of the franchise.
Ghost Protocol was a collection of stellar cast and crew. I mean, this was just a meeting of the minds. I think just everything was right. Everything was perfect. The conditions were perfect. Everything happened the way it was supposed to be. You know, the cinematographer, the music, the director, the producer, you know, Tom Cruise and his cronies, even Jeremy Renner. It just, everything worked.
Oh, you remind, like, this is the first movie that kind of introduced me to Jeremy Renner because I didn't see The Hurt Locker. That would have been his claim to fame at the time. And this was but 5 short months before he would be in The Avengers.
Here's the thing with Jeremy Renner. This is the most I want to see out of Jeremy Renner in a movie.
What do you mean by that?
I do not think Jeremy Renner's a leading man.
No, I think I don't know if he's a good leading man. I like him. I just have, there's something about him that draws me in. But I would say that he's a great supporting role, both in this series and Avengers, even though I felt like the expanded role that he got in Age of Ultron, I thought he pulled off really well.
I completely agree with everything that you said. I like him. There's something about him. There's that je ne sais quoi that just kind of pulls you in. Like you want to shake his hand. You want to be friends with him. But at the same time, you realize he could kick your ass. You know, and it's just, you know, I loved him in American Hustle. I think he was fantastic. I liked him. I like him as Hawkeye, but I don't want a Hawkeye movie. I hated him in The Bourne Legacy. absolutely hated him in the Bourne
Legacy. I didn't hate him in the Bourne Legacy, but the Bourne Legacy kind of was a hard movie to follow.
Oh, good lord. I hate that movie.
We can't talk about this movie without talking about the scene in Dubai in the Burj Khalifa, because I saw this, you know, on a nice big movie screen. I have a really, 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 like, really bad fear of heights. So even though I'm safe in the movie theater and just watching this on the big screen, I've got the palm sweat going throughout that whole scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was some great suspense. Literally.
Yeah, and it was just, I think the interaction between Peg and Renner and Cruz was really seamless in that scene, and it really just worked. I mean, that's why I really like this crew together, because the chemistry, all this, it just works.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I will say that as much as I liked 3 and 1, Ghost Protocol is the first time where I feel like the Mission Impossible movie is a team movie. I mean, mm-hmm. Tom Cruise is still the star and will get the biggest action sequences, but before then, I mean, MI1, he really didn't have a team. He had a ragtag team. And even in the mm-hmm. third one, when you have Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Maggie Q, they're really kind of just side players. They don't get a whole lot to do. In this one, you get Simon Pegg, Jeremy Renner, and we didn't mention her yet, but I love Paula Patton in this film.
Why didn't we get Paula Patton in Rogue Nation? Do you know the story behind that?
I don't know the story behind that, but when I talk about Rogue Nation, let me just say this. I loved Paula Patton in this movie. I think she kicked ass. I would love to see her in Mission Impossible 6. The woman that they put in for Rogue Nation, within 5 minutes of her introduction, you're like, Paula who?
Aw.
I don't mean it to sound that degrading, but the woman in Rogue... Well, I'll save it for the Rogue Nation talk, but yeah.
Well, let's... Okay, I mean... There's not much to talk about with Ghost Protocol other than everything just worked. Everything, like, the action sequences were great. The writing was great.
The only thing that doesn't quite work is the main villain. I mean, when you compare it to Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's kind of a nameless Michael Nyquist.
I guess that's the bad part, is because I barely even remember him. You know, like, it's so bad for me to say, because I love the movie. And a big part of Mission Impossible and Bond and Bourne and everything like that is the villain, not just the action. But it's so sad for me to say it. Like, when you said the villain, I was just like, wait, oh, crap, who was the villain? I can't even remember who it was. And I like that guy as an actor. He's a Swedish actor, and I think he's a solid actor, but I just don't think it was right for the story.
He just didn't make that big of an impression, and especially when you have to follow up Seymour Hoffman, is what I'm saying. Like, you know, It just was kind of bland. The only one I really remembered was the French girl assassin who ends up getting thrown off the building. And actually, funny enough, she's the Bond girl, this time Inspector.
So. Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah.
But yeah, that was the only problem that I had with Ghost Protocol. And it's a problem that I'm very happy to say is rectified in Rogue Nation.
Okay, so let's just go into Rogue Nation. Now, everybody listening at home, this is going to be a spoiler-free review of Rogue Nation, obviously, because I haven't seen it yet. So my loss is your gain.
I saw Rogue Nation the day it came out, July 31st. It was only a few weeks ago. And the buzz on this film was that it was as good, if not better, than Ghost Protocol. It even has the exact same Rotten Tomatoes score, which I've never seen two films be of the same quality, like, back to back. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. even Bond, you usually have one good one and then a not so good one, which I'm hoping is a spell that's broken by Spectre. But so I went in with pretty high expectations, and then of course our mutual friend Lee from Scotland, Lee Nostromo, got to see it before me, because he's, you know, ahead of us in the time zone, and he was already calling it like his favorite movie of the summer. So my expectations were pretty high. So I go and I watch it, and I gotta say, I ended up really loving it. And you know, it's a good sign for me personally, because I haven't revealed my ranking yet. The first time I went in, that was like, I came out, and it's a good sign when I'm asking, did I like this more than Ghost Protocol?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a legitimate question, and I have to say that, having seen it two more times after that, just to see if that was just the initial watching, I'm just hyped, or, you know, let's go in and watch it again and again. I can say now, after three times, my ranking of these films is Rogue Nation, Ghost Protocol, 3, 1, 2.
Okay. All right. That's solid. That's solid.
This one is my favorite now.
Now, what do you think Rogue Nation did better than Ghost Protocol?
Well, first of all, I mentioned the villain. I think that the villain, actually, it's, you know, there's one main villain, but they're going up against the Syndicate, quote unquote, mm-hmm. in this film, which is not a spoiler because you've seen the trailers. The Syndicate's all over the place in the trailer.
Are you talking about Spectre or wait, what?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty much Spectre, which is, you know, begs the question because this was also originally slated to come out at Christmas time, this one, and then got moved up to July. And part of that was so that they didn't have to go against Star Wars, which I think, yeah. you know, good choice.
Solid but choice.
Second of all, I wonder if, you know, they didn't want to go come out that close to Spectre either, because the thing that they're dealing with in this movie is very much like Spectre.
This movie's had a lot of those issues. Like you just mentioned Star Wars and Spectre and also Rogue Nation and Rogue One. Star Wars Rogue One were announced at the same exact time. And so Paramount actually made a deal with Disney where they're like, hey, this was a coincidence. Sorry this happened. Please do not promote Rogue One until Rogue Nation is released. And that's what happened.
Well, actually, and it worked out fine because right now Disney needs to throw all their marketing into Force Awakens. I mean, Rogue One they can worry about next year after Rogue Nation is come and gone. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they didn't have too much of a problem there.
Oh, no.
So the villain in both the Syndicate and the head of the Syndicate is better. Like, I actually felt like they were more of a presence, they were more of a threat, and they're more of a constant throughout the movie, whereas, you know, the villain in Ghost Protocol kind of came and went until that final action sequence in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, I mentioned this earlier, but the female lead that they got in this movie, her name is Rebecca Ferguson. I think she's a Swedish actress, but I'm not sure. She plays a British woman in the film. I was really sad going into this film knowing that Paula Patton wasn't coming back because I thought she kicked ass in the fourth one. And that was the first time, even though I liked Maggie Q in the third one, I felt like the Paula Patton was the first time a female agent was really front and center and mm-hmm. treated as a pretty much equal to Cruise. But this woman, I don't know where she came from. I heard she was in Hercules last year, but that's about all I know her from. Within 5 minutes, all my fears about Paula Patton not being in this film went away. Her introduction to this film kicks ass, and she is doing some... I mean, I'll spoil a little bit. This woman really is an equal to Ethan Hunt. This is the best female character in any Mission Impossible film. I will stake my word on that.
Even more than Emmanuel Barrett in the first one.
Yes, I think so, personally.
Well, it says right here that she did fitness and stunt training consisting of 6 weeks of 6 hours a day training, including Pilates, fight choreography, and stunt practice.
I mean, it's no joke, Tristan. I mean, this woman is doing some Black Widow shit in this film. Like, and I'm talking about, like, Black Widow in Winter Soldier sort of stuff. Like, okay. Very, very physical, very, very... I'd say she could kick ScarJo's ass in those films, but she's fantastic. She's my favorite female in any of these. I really hope that they actually do bring her back in six because she was so amazing in this film. I'd say she steals it from Cruise, quite frankly.
Well, I just read that Paula Patton was not available for the film. Like, she was asked back, but scheduling conflicts ensued.
A couple more things. The direction, I think, is great. I really hope that they actually do break whatever trend they have going, because whether it's been planned or not, it's been a different director each time. I really hope McQuarrie actually comes back, because I think this is the best directed out of all of them. And I also think that this has my favorite suspense scene in any of them too. I mean, the Burj Khalifa in Ghost Protocol was great. Langley in the first one was great too. But there is a scene in the middle of this film that takes place in this facility in Morocco. I'm not going to say more than that. It involves some underwater hijinks, but it is very, 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 very good. And I can't wait for you to see it. Maybe I've hyped you up too much because you have a tendency to dislike good things.
Oh, dude, we went the entire show without you saying that, and then you had to pull that bull crap up. Okay,
it wouldn't be a nerd party without it.
Ugh.
But I would be shocked if you ended up hating this movie. Maybe you like Ghost Protocol and 3 better, or maybe you still like 1 the best, but I would be shocked if you think that this is a bad movie. I really would.
Well, I severely doubt that's going to happen because, I mean, it's got a 93%. I mean, I've hated movies in the 90% percentile on Rotten Tomatoes before.
Most wanted man, lest we not forget.
God, yeah, speaking of Philip Seymour Hoffman. But the thing is, I mean, like, this was loved by you, this is loved by Lee, you know, I think the community seems to think this is a great film, and I'm not trying to say that I'm just going to follow what the community says, but I have high hopes for this film.
Not only is this a great film, I went one step further now that I've seen it a few times. This has actually become my favorite summer movie this year. 2 years in a row where the least expected movie becomes my favorite. Last year it was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and this year it's Mission Impossible. But now that we're reaching the end of summer, really, my top five for summer is not what I thought it would be. But there are things in there that I would thought would end up there, but not in the ranks that they did.
Well, you know that Paramount had faith in this movie even before it was released, because 2 days before it was released, Mission Impossible 6 was announced.
Yeah, well, I mean, they do that all the time, though, right?
Well, I mean, not with the Mission Impossible.
I suppose that's true. And actually, what's interesting about 6 is that they've scheduled it. I mean, Mission Impossibles have been, you know, many years in between. Even between Ghost Protocol and this one has been 4 years. Mm-hmm. Mission Impossible 6 is slated, I believe, in 2 or 3 years, which is going to be the shortest return between sequels.
Right now, I'm not seeing a date.
I thought I heard a date.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but right now I'm not seeing a date. I'm just seeing that it's announced.
Right. Well, they're going to do it. I mean,
they're going to do it.
And like I said, I hope McQuarrie comes back, and I hope Rebecca Ferguson comes back, but I can't wait. This has made me a really, like, Mission Impossible diehard. I love this film. I've seen it 3 times. I'm probably going to see it more times before it leaves theaters.
All right. So give us your ranking one more time.
Rogue Nation. This is from best to worst. Rogue Nation, Ghost Protocol, 3, 1, 2. But I've liked every single one except 2.
Now, here's the thing with me. I'm having a hard time because I'm going to say that from best to worst is Mission Impossible. I still teeter on the fence with Ghost Protocol in number 3. I mean, I just, like, I it depends on when you ask me, because here's the thing is that for the longest time, like, after I saw it in the theater, after my wife and I saw it in the theater, I said, I was like, yeah, I still like 3 more. And she goes, are you kidding? Ghost Protocol was way more fun. Then I once we bought it, I watched it again. I was like, you know what? Maybe I do like Ghost Protocol more. But the thing is, Protocol is more fun than 3, but 3 has some really insane heart-pounding action sequences. So I think as of right now, I'm going to go 1-3, Ghost Protocol. I haven't seen Rogue Nation yet, and ending with 2, because I've liked all of them a lot except for 2. 2, if 2 had a groin, I'd kick it.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that, well, actually, I can say this as a newbie to the franchise, you can go from 1 to 3 and really not miss anything.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And what's really funny is that in number 2, that's the only film where Ethan Hunt is actually working with IMF.
Yeah, it's true. Especially even in this new one, IMF is dissolved, but you get that in the trailer. So that's,
yeah, you get it in the trailer. Like in the first one, he was a rogue agent. In 3, he was a rogue agent halfway through. In Ghost Protocol, he was...
They're all disavowed in Ghost
They're all Protocol. Disavowed at the beginning of the film. And then in Rogue Nation, the whole organization is just gone and dissolved. It's crazy. So,
right.
But, I mean, 2 was the worst one, so maybe it works.
Maybe it does work. I don't know how they keep repeating this dynamic. And I've yet to see, at least Rotten Tomatoes-wise, I've yet to see a franchise where the later entries keep getting higher and higher ratings. You know what I'm saying? That's almost unheard of.
Yeah, it is true. And I'm pretty sure that Rogue Nation is going to, like, once it's done with its theatrical run, it's probably going to be the top grossing.
Yeah, it hasn't even opened in China yet, which, you know, is going to be a bit.
Yeah, that's going to be huge. All right, well, thank you so much for listening. That was our review of the Mission Impossible franchise, our retrospective, if you will. That was our ranking, and we want to hear your rankings. Email us at contact@thenerdparty.com. Find us on Twitter. I'm at TheInsaneRobin. Matt, you are?
I am at MHanson0207.
And you can also go to the website, thenerdparty.com. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/thenerdparty. Like us there. Respond to us there. Let us know your rankings. Let us know if you're looking forward to Mission Impossible 6 or you think it should have ended with 5.
Thank you so much for listening to The Nerd Party. That concludes our show, and this podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Coming up next week.
The show's going to be all about our personal lives.
I hate the 405.
Behind the scenes.
How'd the surgery go?
all fine. But I kept biting the stitches off, so I threw this thing on.
Our relationships?
I don't see how it's ever going to work out with you and I.
You can say it, Dad. He's a bear.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
When it comes to a family car, it has to be refined, beautifully designed, as well as being comfortable to drive.
But a car needs to be fun to drive, responsive and sporty. I don't want a boring car just because I've got a family.
But it should ooze class and make you feel $1 million when you get in.
Ah, but it shouldn't cost $1 million. It needs to be affordable, with 0% APR representative, a £750 deposit for a Mazda, and no minimum customer deposit.
It's got to be the Mazda 3. Exactly.
Funny, I was thinking the same thing.
For more information, search Mazda 3 or visit your local Mazda dealer. Mazda personal contract purchase, T's and C's apply. Finance subject to status, 18s or over. Guarantee may be required. Mazda Financial Services excludes sport black models.